You're listening to Fun Shack.
I'm Ross Butler, and today I'm talking with Paul Newsom, Head of Portfolio Management at Unigestion, a 20 billion euro asset manager headquartered in Geneva. Paul has been at Unigestion for two decades, during which he's set up the North American operation and played a key role in its expansion into co-investments, directs and secondaries. Today we talk about his key investment themes, fundraising, secondaries, AI and much, much more.
I hope you enjoy it. Paul, we were just talking off camera about Unigestion and how shockingly ignorant I am about it. But it seems like you do a huge amount. You do direct, proper primary investments into the mid-market. You have secondaries. You have some growth exposure. Mm-hmm. And you are truly global. How does Unigestion work and function as a coherent, you know, profitable business?
See, I joined the firm 20 years ago. And when I joined, we were still global. We were smaller. We were more of a fund investing shop. So fund of funds. We had started co-investing. We'd started our secondaries business. And then over time, we've just grown. We've grown our team. We've grown our network. So today we have probably, we count almost 700 investment partners. That includes fund managers. That includes industry specialists. It includes fundless sponsors. And they show us funds, they show us deals, they show us secondaries, co-investments. So it's just evolved into what it is today.
So you have 700 people today. How many?
700 investment partners, we call them, who are fund managers, entrepreneurs, industry specialists, fundless sponsors who show us deals. So that is also a network that we leverage off, and it enables us to invest what we do.
And what about your core team?
The core private equity team, we're 50 people, almost 50 people. Unigestion as a whole is about 180 people, because private equity, we're about $11 billion of assets under management out of a total of $20 billion. Because we, in addition to private equity, we have a listed equity business. So the private equity team, we benefit from this larger Unigestion platform. But then we have the 50 people. These are the investment specialists who are going out doing deals.
So just so I'm clear on the 700, these are people that source you deals, or are they also fund managers who you partner with?
They can be fund managers with whom we invest in our primary fund business, our fund of fund business. They can be partners who show us deals for our direct business. These can be also fund managers or industry specialists or fundless sponsors. And they can also be partners who show us secondary deals. So this is just a network that's grown over the last 20, 25 years.
And you started out, so you're headquartered in Geneva. And
yes.
You're in the UK when you joined 20 years ago.
Yes.
And so you've been busy setting up offices. And I think you set up the North American operation.
Yeah. Yes. I set up the private equity part of the North American operation. So I started in London in 2002. I was focusing mainly on European fund investments. In 2005, I volunteered to go to the US and begin our US presence. We'd already been investing in US fund managers, but we just didn't have a physical presence there yet. There I started to build a team. I was there 4 years. And then in 2009, I was asked by the firm to move to Geneva and head up the global investment team from 2009. And then to continue the story, a few things happened. 2017, we actually acquired a European manager called Akina, who is based out of Zurich. They were also investing in the same part of the market as us, so middle market, as it was called, but only in Europe. It seemed like a perfect match at the time, because they were European specialists with global investors, whereas Unigestion was more of a global investor with mainly European clients.
So that was a big deal for you.
So yeah, it was a real step change in our development. If you look at the history of the development of the private equity team. So pre-2017, we were maybe $2.5 billion of AUM in private equity. Post-2017, after the merger, we were $5 billion.
Right.
And that triggered the next stage of growth to what we are today, which is $10, $11 billion of assets under management.
And you started out primarily as fund investors, but over time you've become direct investors. How does that transition?
Yeah, so if I start from, we really started, the private equity team started in about the mid-90s in Unigestion. So before I joined. Unigestion dates back to 1972, in fact, when the Unigestion firm was founded. In the mid-90s, Unigestion formed its first fund, institutional fund of fund for institutional investors. And then that's when we started doing fund investments. When I joined in 2002, we were raising we'd just raised our third fund of funds, and we were just raising our first secondary fund. So bearing in mind, this was quite a pioneering for a European headquartered firm to form a secondaries fund in 2000, 2001. It was quite early.
Yes, you've got an entrepreneurial spirit in the culture of Unigestion, presumably, and that's how you've managed to follow the market in the right directions and build out a diversified private markets platform.
Yeah, exactly. And then also on the co-investing, we had sporadically done co-investments as any fund investor was doing at the time. But we didn't really have a coherent, admittedly, 20 plus years ago, we didn't really have a coherent co-investment strategy. Hmm. And it was really around 2007 or so when we formed a coherent strategy where we were just being a lot more active about doing our co-investments, more targeted with our fund managers, and we started developing a specialist co-investment team at that time.
So of your 50 core people, you have a co-investment team and a secondaries team.
Yes, exactly.
Direct teams on the ground in different regions?
Yes. So for example, the co-investment direct team, we call it direct because we also co-lead and lead our own deals now. So we've evolved that far from the direct activity. We have 13 people out of that 50 who just spend their days doing direct investing. And then for the secondary team, we have about, I think we have 11 people who are focused on secondaries. Now, an important point to mention is that these are not silos. These are not teams which do stuff on their own and don't talk to the rest. They're absolutely benefiting from the direct team benefits from our fund relationships, because that's where we source a lot of deals from. That's where we get a lot of intel from. And the secondaries team also benefits from our fund relationships, because obviously GPs who show us secondary deals, they like the fact that we can also do fund investing. So the whole, if you were to think about these three areas, they're overlapping activities.
Yeah. So I can see that there are obvious synergies there. My feeling though is that although Unigestion is of some scale, you're not like mega, and yet you have as much diversification as, you know, some of the largest houses have. And so I'm just interested about how you, because on paper, the synergies are there, but in practice, getting these things to work can be very difficult to get the culture, particularly across the world, across many different geographies and cultures, to get everyone to come together. How does that work in practical terms? And where do you sit in that? You personally sit in that process?
Yeah, I think I would say, if you think about what is the common thread across everything we do? And I think we say that is ultimately we are giving our investors access to exciting, hard to access companies which are resilient, they're niche, they're leaders in their market niche, they're very cash flow generative, we're not taking stupid risks, limited leverage. So these are companies which investors would love to have in their own portfolios. And then we give them the choice. Do you want a direct portfolio to give you a more concentrated approach with perhaps a higher upside? Do you want a secondaries approach which gives you more cash velocity? Or do you want more of a broader primaries, diversified primaries approach? So that's the common thread. And we also, across that, we think in terms of investment themes. So we have seven investment themes, and this is the lens through which we look at deals. And these are areas or tailwinds which drive growth uncorrelated to GDP.
So for example?
So for example, future of work is one of our seven investment themes. And so future of work, that includes education, reskilling, et cetera. We did an investment through our secondary fund, just on the eve of COVID. It's an enterprise software company which helps companies give remote access to their employees. So imagine, this was already a tailwind before COVID. Mm. More and more people were wanting to work remotely. Now just imagine what the COVID lockdown did with everyone working from home. It went through the roof. So many of these themes were almost accelerated by COVID and other difficulties. Healthcare is another one of our themes. Climate is another one of our themes. Service efficiency. So these are all themes which we've pretty much focused on for the last five years plus, and they're fine tuned from time to time, but they drive the investments in our portfolios.
So there's a number of ways a private equity firm can do this. Typically, historically, let's say it's been more sectoral. Mm-hmm. But you do themes rather than sectors.
Yeah, I mean, it leads to certain sectors.
Yeah, of course.
So if you look at our portfolios, we probably the sector which you'll see the most is healthcare. I'd say that's 25 to 30% of our portfolios tend to be exposed to healthcare. Education is a big sector for us. As I mentioned, climate and resource efficiency. Mm. Has been a key sector for us.
It seems to be everywhere. Climate.
Yes.
I mean, people have been talking about it for a long time, but it seems to be everywhere in terms of like deals happening at the moment. People are looking at it as a financial opportunity.
Absolutely. Because this is a massive topic in itself, but we really believe that is where you can get very interesting returns whilst delivering an impact at the same time. And historically, there's been this almost what we think a myth that if you're going after impact, you're compromising returns. But we think on the contrary, in the space like climate, you're actually getting better returns. Some of our best performing investments have been on the climate side. We made more than a 10x recently on a company that provides a charge electric vehicle charging infrastructure, for example. I mean, for obvious reasons, it's a hugely growing space.
Well, private equity is very good at dealing with change, or allowing the corporate world to respond to change. And it's an area of big change, and perhaps even more change than anyone really wants with the energy crisis at the moment. That maybe that's going to throw up some additional opportunities in the UK and Europe.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
Brilliant. So, so that's the direct side. And so I suppose I'd also like to kind of, okay, you've got the themes, but then you've got the global, you know, the global aspect, which must kind of, it's just another layer of opportunity, but also complexity to manage.
Yes, complexity. But then it also gives us quite an interesting angle, because firstly, we have these seven themes, yes, but they're applied very differently in each region. So climate is a very big topic here in Europe, less of a topic, or it's behind in North America. Certain areas like the technology side of it is growing very strongly, and then also in Asia there are certain aspects which are growing at different rates. So So often we'll see, we'll think of it, we'll see a theme which is very interesting in one area, in one region, but it's not so interesting in another. So it allows us to play our themes differently in different areas. That's one thing. And the other thing is, because we're investing in typically smaller companies, they may be founder-led by the time we come into them, they're obviously less professionally run. They're probably local, so they absolutely will benefit from an investor with a global platform. So we've invested in companies which often have a buy and build strategy element to them, and that so for example, we invested in a Swiss based firm called Home Instead, which provides care at home for seniors. And they just made an acquisition in Australia, and that was one of the reasons they brought us on board, to give them that global platform to help them due diligence, source opportunities in other geographies.
So that's the direct side. But can I just come back to this preoccupation, I guess, I'm having with the unigestion structure? Because in practical terms, how do you make use of the geographic knowledge and the different product knowledge? So for example, do you have a single investment committee? How often do you meet, and how do you meet? How does the interaction internally work?
So each sub team, let's say direct, secondary, primary team, they're all run globally. So let me use the secondary team as an example, because I know I've been talking a lot about the direct team. Yeah. So they will have weekly team meetings, and then there will be deal teams. So we'll source deals, and they will. There'll be two or three people working on a deal. It may not necessarily be just two or three people from the same location. It might be, for example, we're looking at we might be looking at a US deal. So in the waste and recycling space, which we did a deal there recently. So typically there'll be two local people working on that deal. And then maybe a European person might work on that deal because they also have not sector knowledge from having done a deal in Europe. So we think it's very healthy to have that cross-regional participation in deals, because then it brings different perspectives.
Sorry to interrupt. And these individuals would be incentivized in a way that's aligned.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, the secondary team all share from the global carried interest in our secondary fund. In fact, the whole team participates to some degree in the carried interest of each fund. So everyone is aligned.
Right.
Great. And then so they are encouraged to bring high conviction deals to their team, the sub team. And they'll only bring deals to the team if it's to a certain level of conviction. And then the team, they will agree on the deals they're working on and resourcing, etc. And eventually deals are brought to the investment committee for a first look.
Right.
And the investment committee is a global investment committee. I'm a member of the investment committee. There's five of us. We meet every week, every Wednesday, and deals are presented first as an early warning. We call them early warning memos. Mm-hmm. And that's at that stage, these are deals which the investment teams feel very strongly about, but they would like to get initial feedback from the investment committee of due diligence areas they should look at, any ideas the committee might have, or references or contacts that they should talk to.
So they haven't submitted a formal paper at this point. They've just given you the highlights.
It's still quite a detailed sort of draft paper, if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, it still could be a 20, 30 page paper.
Right.
And then what the investment committee does is we allocate one person from the investment committee to be the review director, who's the devil's advocate to the deal. And I've often taken that role. And it's a very useful role, because not only do you come in completely unbiased and unemotional to the deal. But you can see the workings of the deal. You can really see the work that the due diligence team has done. I, as the review director, would get to meet the management team, the fund manager, the GP behind the deal, and hear the arguments for and against the deal. And then it comes back to the investment committee with the final recommendation. The main point is that the investment committee is not just at the very, very end of the process after all the work has been done, and they just give the thumbs up or thumbs down. I mean, they're very much integrated into the process.
Slight sidetrack.
Yes.
While we're talking about the investment selection process, I noticed on one of your communications that you have an AI tool that helps. I was at a technical private equity conference last week, and a couple of people asked me, I don't know why they asked me, if I ever come across any private equity firms using AI as part of their primary selection tool. And I hadn't really, but you have one. Could you?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. It's our pride and joy. We call it, it's called Pepper. It stands for Private Equity Predictive Performance. So performance.
That's good.
Yeah, very good. we did an internal competition to come up with the...
It's a great way of doing
the best
things,
name.
Yeah.
And also, it gives an added spice to our investment process. So it works both ways. It's now a very important part of the process. It's something that's been developed over the last 5 years. And it was initiated by... We have these links to academic institutions. So we've got a link to Imperial College London. We also work very closely with the EPFL, which is the university in the Technical University in Lausanne. And there every year we take on students to do internships. And these are master's students who have very technical backgrounds. And 5 years ago, one of these students, we gave them the project to say, look, what predicts performance better? Is it the original LBO model that was put together by the investment team? Or is it some other aspects of the deal that we're able to predict the performance, irrespective of the LBO model? And
sorry, what do you mean by LBO model? The investment case?
Basically the business plan.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Showing the input into an Excel spreadsheet, giving a predicted return. And it's essentially just the numbers. Or are there other aspects to a deal that could give you better predictions? And of course, I say of course, because we've seen
the model.
Of course, it's there are other aspects to a deal. And in the end, we were able to, through the analysis, we found there are 40 variables in a deal that can predict very accurately the ultimate performance of a deal. I mean, up to 80% accuracy. It's very impressive. And these are, so what are these 40 variables? That includes EBITDA, so the obvious ones to start with, like EBITDA growth, margin, debt levels, etc. But also other aspects like sector performance, experience of the management team, gender diversity, ESG, and then other macro telltales as well. So these are the 40 variables. So when a deal comes in, we can input these variables into the model, and the model will output the probability that the deal will deliver a better than 2x return. And that probability might be, it might come out as 65% or 70%, or it might come out as 45, 50%. And that can steer us towards whether we pursue the deal or not. Mm. And simplistically speaking, we can say if it's 50% or worse, we don't bother. If it's 50% to 60% in the orange zone, perhaps we look at some, we look at the red flags, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then if it's 60% or greater, we go forward and do the, we go forward with the human part of the due diligence. So mm-hmm. So in the end, it's an enhancement mm. to our process.
And if it's below 50%, you really wouldn't even.
No, I mean I say simplistically because
rules of thumb. Not
because
hard, yeah.
Because actually it will tell you what the red flags are. It'll tell you which of the variables.
Yeah, and they could be explained away.
Yes, and there could be a reason. There could be a weakness in that variable. Yeah, they could be explained away.
Right. And so it's a transparent tool. It's not like it's telling you something.
It's not a black box. It's not like the computer says. Yeah. No.
Right.
No.
So just to play devil's advocate, the analysis was done at a moment in time. Presumably you have to keep doing it to make
sure. Yeah, I mean, it was done using over 3,000 deals in our database. Mm. And these are deals from underlying fund managers. These are co-investments we've done in the past. These are deals where we now know the outcome. And when we backtested it, what we did is every time, let's say we took a deal in 2010, which we're going to backtest on, mm. we'd only allow the tool to learn from all deals up until 2010 to apply the learning to that deal. And then we saw, well, what was the outcome? Was it correct or not? In 80% of cases, the tool was correct in the prediction. But we're refining it all the time, of course. Yeah. So every year we get another year's worth of data, and every time we run the model, we get slightly different outcomes. So it's always work in progress, and
so it's not. And this is this. I used to be a journalist. This is the skeptical side. It's not just a marketing thing that you say. This is something that you genuinely use that informs your.
Absolutely, yeah. And the investment committee, we are very interested in what the tool says. And it's pretty much the first question. And it's in the paper. The paper will say, the investment paper will say almost on the first page, this is what the tool predicts for this investment.
Given how much money is at stake in private markets, it's a wonder that, you know, the market isn't employing the top professors to be crunching this all the time to get the best possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I know a lot of other firms are working on this as well, and they're different levels of progression. I suppose we've also benefited from the fact that we're now benefiting from our history. We're benefiting from the fact that we've been doing it for 30 years, and we've got 3,000 companies that have been and gone through our portfolio, and
much harder for an average mid-market primary-only. Operation to do,
because private equity is a notoriously opaque class, and it's difficult to really get 40 to get the information for 40 variables on every company. And that's required a lot of legwork on our side to get that data in order to run our machine learning.
Okay, that was a long diversion, but very interesting topic.
And by the way, we've also applied it to funds selection. That's company selection. Fund selection, it's the same principle, but different variables. For our fund selection, it's 23 variables. We still call it our Pepper tool, because it's the same underlying
model. How does it perform relative to the other
primes? Yeah, similar. I mean, in this case, it gives a prediction of ultimate IRR. So you can actually fine-tune the model. And you can overlay it to a fund database like a Preqin or a PitchBook. Mm. You can overlay it. It's like an add-on, and it can look into the like a Preqin, and and select those companies which will perform above a given hurdle.
So 30 years into the future, when we've got an incredibly liquid, in a sense, private market industry, you could use this as almost an indexing tool, like a robotic selection.
Yes.
Tool maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. It's going to be a key. It will become a very key tool to be used in the future. Right. Although you could argue that if managers know, or there is this tool, they can play it.
Yeah, it's a non-stationary situation. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
they can say, apparently we need to have a great ESG to give good performance. So quick, let's create an ESG team.
Or exactly.
Apparently gender diverse, you know, we need to be 50-50.
And suddenly the whole thing changes. You put out a note the other day that I read, and I saw that fundraising, you mentioned, I think it was in, so don't quote me, although I'm trying to quote you, Q3 fundraising significantly down, but not just that, highly concentrated in a small number of managers, which I found very interesting, particularly since I don't think any of the managers you quoted were like the obvious mega buyout managers. So that's interesting in itself. So anyway, it's a difficult fundraising market.
Yeah, I think the market has dropped precipitously in the last 6 to 9 months. I mean, 2021 was a peak. When now we look back, was clearly a peak. It was a crazy time in the private equity market. Investments, exit activity through the roof, fundraising through the roof. So it's no surprise that we're down on last year. But I guess the surprise is how quickly we've come down. And indeed, investment activity, exit activity are well down. Q3 especially was well down on Q3 of year ago. And fundraising, on the face of it, it's not significantly down. But then if you look into the numbers, yes, it's clearly, it's concentrated now. It's driven by the mega cap funds raising. People like Advent raised, they raised, what, 25, 26 billion. That's almost one third of what was raised in a given quarter. So that clearly warps the numbers to some extent. So it's clear that the smaller managers are having a tougher time, or the non-mega cap managers are having a tougher time raising. It's clear that investors themselves are thinking carefully about their allocations. They've probably got some denominator issues going on. They've also probably got a slowdown in distributions coming back. So this is affecting what they do as well. So it's an interesting time. The other aspect is also valuations. You know, where are valuations going? Because public markets have fallen 20-30% this year. Private equity performance hasn't yet shown a dip. I mean, in fact, in our portfolios, we've seen them going up. I think a lot of investors would see that. So it begs the question, what's going on? Public markets are all about pricing in expectations. And if you look at the macro side, you've got inflation, you've got energy prices, interest rates, you've got the four C's that people talk about, you know, COVID, climate, conflict, and commodity pricing. So all this is playing on the markets. And it's pricing in an anticipated downturn, recession. But this, we've yet to see a real impact in the real economy. I mean, I was in London going out last night. All the restaurants are packed. The bars are packed. World Cup's going on, but you don't feel the impact yet in the real economy. And neither do you yet feel the impacts in private equity. Because private equity, ultimately, the valuations in private equity is based on real-time information of the fundamentals of private companies. And we're not yet seeing impacts on private companies because they're showing, I mean, we look in our portfolio, EBITDAs are growing. That's one aspect.
So private market valuations are less forward-looking than public, would you say then? Is that what you...
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yes, there are, yes. But the other aspect is, because then you might ask, well, hang on, what about mark to market? If you look at private multiples versus public multiples over the last, say, 10 years, they were, from, say, 2013 to pre-COVID, it was pretty consistent. There was a pretty consistent discount between from private, the private discount to public. Private's been around hovering 11 to 12 to 13. Publics have been around 15. Then in 2020, the publics went up. The markets went crazy in 2020
right,
onwards.
Yes.
And this the therefore, but the private valuations more or less stayed consistent. So the other way of looking at it is actually the drop in public markets in the last 12 months is just a reversion to where we were pre-COVID. So that's it. Maybe I'm looking at it from a glass half full point of view, but that's another way of looking at the valuations. And so if you think about a private equity manager, on one hand, they're looking at they're looking at their portfolio companies, which are still showing growth. On the other hand, they're looking at private multiples, which haven't really shifted. Mm. So they haven't yet got a reason to mark down their portfolios.
Yeah. And so all this feeds into pressures on fund investors, which potentially is an opportunity for your secondaries business.
Yes. Yes, because...
See what I did there?
Very good. Very good. Yeah, because you look at secondary pricing... And you could argue that's a leading indicator because secondary pricing has come down in terms of the discounts have increased in secondary pricing. And I think there is an anticipation in the market that valuations, that private equity valuations will come down come Q4 and come next year when the real economy starts to slow down a bit and there are first order, second order effects at the portfolio company levels. So that's one thing to mention. So you've got the discounts coming down in anticipation of that. The other thing is you've got the supply side. You've got LPs who actually want liquidity, and they either because they're not getting the distributions they want, or because they want to solve their denominator issue.
Is that happening now, or is that?
It's starting to.
Right.
I mean, the prediction was maybe 6 months ago that the secondary market would start to pivot towards more LP stakes, because you know how GP-led deals in the secondary market has been the topic for the last 2-3 years. And the discussion, if you went to a secondaries conference 6 months ago, was, oh yeah, we're very excited about LP stakes coming back, making a comeback. Mm. But that hasn't happened yet. Mm. And I think the key reason for that is that there's still this bid-ask spread where LPs are stubbornly wanting to sell at, say, par. They believe that they can still sell their stakes at close to net asset value, whereas the secondary buyers are saying, no, we want to buy this at a 20-30% discount. And there's this spread which hasn't
that
narrowed
much.
Yet. Yeah, I mean, I'm making
I realize, throwing numbers out. But you didn't say 5%.
No, because the secondary buyers are anticipating a fall at some point. That spread, I don't think, has solved itself yet, and probably will start to solve itself in two ways. One, as one way is that the valuations will come down, so therefore secondary investors won't need such a discount because they've already come down.
Yes.
And secondly, LPs will start to become more motivated.
Yes.
Let's say.
Yes. And what about Unigestion's secondaries business? I don't know much about the secondaries market. What do you have a USP there?
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental USP is we're looking for exciting companies which play our investment themes, which are resilient, And also on the secondary side, we're looking for companies which are at an inflection point. So we can come into these portfolios, companies which either have near-term liquidity or they're about to embark on a tangible value creation initiative, which will give us a quick uptick in valuation. So how do we apply that? We apply that through looking for relatively concentrated portfolios. So our secondary strategy ends up with our secondary funds and end up with perhaps 40, 50 secondary deals with maybe 200, 250 underlying portfolio companies. That's quite concentrated compared to your average secondary fund, which is where they're buying hundreds of stakes in portfolios, leading to almost thousands of underlying companies. So we're quite different in that respect.
Yes. Yeah.
And how do we apply that strategy? Yes, we're doing quite a few GP-leds. These could be single asset continuation funds. They could be multi-assets. And we're also doing some LP stakes in smaller portfolios.
So it's still a lot of work analyzing all of this stuff.
I mean, yeah, it is. Yeah.
I mean, you really want an AI tool to help you out with this part of it.
We do. Yeah. No, we use our AI.
Oh, of course you do, because of the fund side. Yeah, of course you do.
Well, no, but it's also, we can use it for both. This is the beauty of secondaries. You can use it for both. Because when you're doing single assets, you can we apply our tool. When we're looking at funds, we can apply our tool. So it actually sits nicely in the middle there. But it is a lot of work. We see on the secondary side, we see 300 to 400 deals per year. We end up doing 12 to 15 secondary transactions per year.
So if you were to kind of put yourself in the shoes on the other side of the fence and you're an institutional investor, an LP, there's a lot of uncertainty out there. I mean, what would you do, to manage your portfolio? Do you bide your time? Do you take the hit? Are there other tools that you could consider?
If I were, as a private equity investor, I think there are a few things. Firstly, vintage diversification is always key. And I think when you invest if you're an investor in private equity, you don't invest all your money on one day. It's not like buying into a listed mutual fund where you're coming into the market all in one day. In private equity, you invest in a portfolio which gets deployed over two or three years, and that's true for a direct fund, that's true for a secondary fund, that's true for a fund of fund. So that's one strength of private equity, that you get this natural time diversification. And the other aspect of private equity is and then certainly the way we apply is you're investing in fundamentals at the end of the day. You're not investing in emotions. Mm. And when you invest in a company, you're investing into a company because it has a reason to exist, it provides mission critical products and services. In our case, we're looking for companies which have robust cash flows. We're looking for companies which, as I said, which are playing these long-term growth themes. Mm. So in theory, these companies will persist, will perform irrespective of a difficult environment ahead.
Unigestion's grown a lot in many different ways as well since you've been there, so over 20 years. It's very difficult to look in the crystal ball, but I guess the broad question is, how scalable is private equity, private markets generally? And then the more specific question is, how do you see unigestion evolving over the coming years or decade within that?
Private equity is scalable to a point. If you're like us, where you're investing in a certain area, part of the market, you're looking for these exciting companies, but you're building relatively concentrated portfolios. Yes, you can raise our latest direct fund, we're raising a 1 billion euro fund. Our latest secondary fund, it's a 1.5 billion which we'll raise next year, will be 1.5 billion. So we can scale these to a certain extent. We will grow the team. We can do a few more deals in a fund, slightly bigger deals, but there's a limit to that. But there are also other areas I can see us going into. So for example, we're raising our climate impact fund at the moment. Now, at the moment, this is our first fund. It's actually a continuation of a strategy we started 12 years ago. But this particular fund is 300 million. Yes, we can scale that to a certain extent. We can also launch a social impact fund or impact funds in other areas. So that can be scaled. But all of this, I think there'll be a limit. And then also AI tools help you research and development. That allows you to leverage your platform. So if you put that all together, I can see us growing, doubling our AUM in, say, the next five to seven years, but not exponential.
Paul, thank you so much for sparing your thoughts. I feel like I have a rudimentary understanding of how to run an asset manager now. So that's
been my
very
pleasure.
Good of you. Hope your Unigestion goes from strength to strength.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Fund Shack podcast. Make sure you subscribe and visit our website at fund-shack.com for many more video interviews. It's the private capital channel for alternative investment professionals. Thanks for listening.